the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Great. Good morning. Let's read from the Bible together, shall we? If you turn to page 57 of the Green Bible in front of you, you'll find the passage we're looking at, which is Exodus chapter 3 and a bit of chapter 4. It's a long passage, and there's loads of stuff in it as well, which we need to speak about. So we're not going to read it all, and we're not going to talk about it all this morning either. And one thing I would very much recommend that you do is, if you're not too familiar with the passage, have a look at it yourself afterwards. Read it in detail, because we are really just going to skim it this morning. So that's Exodus chapter 3, at page 57. And we'll start from verse 1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this Moses hid his face, because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. That is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the God, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. Go. And so he goes on with the details of the plan and what's going to happen. And at the start of chapter 4, you get Moses' next objection. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? Then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And God does two miracles at this point and tells Moses about a third one that he's kept in reserve. And Moses still isn't convinced. Verse 10, Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. The Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, go. I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. But Moses said, pardon your servant, Lord, please. Send someone else. Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, what about your brother, Aaron the Levite? I know he can speak well. He's already on his way to meet you. His heart will be glad when he sees you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I'll help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so that you can perform the signs with it. And now Moses is fully equipped for his job, and so that's where we'll leave it. Can we have the slides up, please? Thank you. So, this is one of the most interesting series we could possibly be doing here. It's not working? Maybe it's not working. Nothing happening? How's that? That's excellent. Good. Okay, great. So, we're having problems with the audiovisuals this morning. Just, I apologise in case there's anything else. The fonts have changed mysteriously, and this is looking very odd. So, if anything happens, be ready. Okay. So, we're doing a series called God's Big Rescue, about one of the most exciting bits of the Old Testament, I guess. The story of the Exodus is one that's redounded down through the ages. It's captured imaginations. It's fueled liberation movements all over the world. Not least, of course, in the United States, where in the years of slavery and depression, the black people took to the story of the Exodus as a symbol of the hope that they had that God would one of these days set things right. And all of the songs, the spirituals, the images, the ideas, the sermons that came out of that period of history were centered around this fantastic episode from ancient history where God brought a no-hope slave people out of the most severe oppression they could possibly have been in into their own land, into freedom. And so there are a lot of lessons we can learn from God's big rescue. Because God didn't rescue the Israelites just to rescue them. He rescued them for a purpose. And so last week, we were looking at the fact that they were rescued to live effectively. Moses tried by himself to free his people, tried to liberate them, ended up just having to run out of Egypt as a fugitive to the situation where we find him at the start of the passage this morning, herding sheep in the backside of the desert. A footnote to history, a failure, somebody who tried and failed miserably and now is spending the last few years of his life simply herding sheep. No wonder he doesn't want to go back to Egypt. He's been there before and it didn't work last time. This week we're talking about the fact that you're rescued to live powerfully. God has more resources than Moses can well believe. And we're going to see just how he intends to use them in the next few weeks. Next week it'll be about being rescued to live freely as we look at the way in which God sets people free through blood. But we'll get to that one. Then it's about living securely as God supplies the needs of the Israelites as they move through the desert. Then rescued to live radically as God gives them a system of living, a pattern of life, laws that are completely unlike the laws of any nations around them to help them to live in a radical, simple, different way that represents his mind and his character. So that's where we're going with the whole thing. And we're talking this week about rescued to live powerfully. The power of God in our lives is what this passage is all about. Now, you might be here a bit like Moses this morning, a bit cynical, saying, oh, well, it sounds great, but I've been there. I've tried. When I was younger, I tried to live for God with everything I had. And what happened? I fell flat on my face. Not been there, done that, got the T-shirt. Sounds great. I'll listen, but there's no way I'm going to do anything as a result of this morning. My fingers have been burned before. Well, that's certainly the way that Moses felt about it. Certainly because he was somebody who felt that he was probably approaching 80 at this point. His life was over. The story had already been written. There was nothing more for him to do. And the more important thing that God did was to give him a vision of the kind of God he was. And I think there are three things in this passage that Moses found out about God. The first thing is that we have a God who amazes us with his glory. He's unlike any other God in the universe. Moses had been brought up in the court of Pharaoh. He knew all about Egyptian theology, the ideas they had about the gods, their myths, their stupendous tales of the supernatural. But this was a God like nothing he'd ever heard of before, except in the tales that his sister told him as she was bringing him up, about the God that his father worshipped, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God who'd moved and done things through history, an amazing God, much bigger than any of the Egyptian gods. And God tries to show Moses here too that he's a God who addresses us. He's not a God who's somewhere up in the heavens that we have to guess about, somebody hidden behind the clouds. He's somebody who speaks directly to people who are listening. And the third thing that you find out is that this is a God who engages us. Because one, just as soon as Moses has got into his mind, this is the most amazing God, and he's talking to me, God says to him, not once but several times in this passage, now go. God doesn't talk to you just to pass the time of day. Hi, Moses, how is it down in the desert? Bit hot this morning? Yes, okay, well, I'll send you a cold wind. Everything's all right up here. Yes, we're having a good time. It's not that kind of conversation. It's a conversation with a purpose. Moses, I'm speaking to you because I have a serious plan for your people and your life. You fit right in the center of my purposes. Now, go. So, let's unpack those three things a little bit. Let's look at the first one. A God who amazes us. Moses who, as you've seen from the reading, is not very keen to do anything for God particularly. He's an old man, he just wants to stay at home and think, ah, those were the days 50 years ago, I remember what it was like. And God's not prepared to let him sit in his bath chair like that. God wants him to do something. And so Moses says to God, well, what do I tell them about you? I mean, God has sent me to you. Which God? What's his name? Tell us about him. What am I supposed to say? It's a long time since you spoke to our people. What are you like? What are you really about? And God says simply, you can tell them, I am who I am. You can't get further back than that. I'm the God who's the very center of existence. I can't be described in any other terms. You can't use adjectives to describe it. I am who I am. That's it. I'm the ultimate. I'm the end of the line. Now, that name means at least three things, doesn't it? First of all, it means we're talking about a God who has no needs. We serve him, but we don't contribute anything to him. He's full. He's complete in himself. He has all the resources we need. He has everything to start with. And we serve him, not because we're doing him good in some kind of a way, but just as a response to his incredible glory. That's the first thing. Second, if his name is I am who I am, that means he never changes. I am who I am implies I was who I was. I will be who I will be. I'm never going to alter. I'm always going to be the same. And so although it's hundreds of years ago, Moses, Abram's been dead a long time, Jacob and Isaac have been in their tombs for ages and ages, I'm still the same God. The way I dealt with them, I'll deal with you. No change, just the same thing. And the third thing it means is no, it needs no changes, no failures. I will never let you down. I'm consistent. When I make a promise, I keep it. You can trust me to the ends of the earth. If you stake your life on me, you win every time. It's never a gamble. There's never a failure because I am ultimate dependability. That was what God wanted to get across about himself. Now you might say, well, Moses doesn't seem to believe it. That's absolutely right. It takes us all a lifetime, doesn't it, to understand that God really is dependable, that God really does never change. We don't trust him. Our hearts shrink away from that. We tend to think he's going to let me down. He's going to leave me. He's not going to do what he promised. And he does it again and again and again. And through the course of his lifetime, Moses was to learn the lesson he was so slow to learn in this passage. God can be trusted. He's the ultimate. He's the I am who I am. He can't be anything different from what he is. And he's a God who addresses us. He's not somebody who stays behind the clouds. He talks to us. He says what he's got to say. Now, this must have been quite staggering for Moses because God had spoken to people before. But if you think about the history of the Israelites, it goes something like this. First of all, Abraham goes to Canaan when God sends him there. That's God speaking out of the blue to a man for the first time in a long, long time. And this is the start of God's plan. Happened somewhere about 2091 BC. We don't know for sure because all of these dates are a bit of guesswork at this particular point, but still, that's what happened. And then Isaac is born in response to God's promise in 2066. And through Isaac's life, God speaks to Isaac as well. And then Isaac has a son called Jacob. And Jacob again meets with God again and again. One amazing night, he even has a wrestling match with God. He sees a ladder going up to heaven. God is very close to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then when Joseph is born, the son of Jacob, same thing happens again. Joseph has dreams. Joseph hears messages from God, even when he's in a prison in Egypt. God is very close. God is speaking all the time. It's an amazing patch of history. And then Joseph dies round about, 1805 BC. Where does Moses come in? Watch this. Moses is right at that end of the timeline. There's a period of hundreds of years when God is saying nothing, when he's silent, when it's not the right time for him to speak. And so suddenly he comes in now and speaks to Moses. No wonder Moses found it difficult to believe. Because God doesn't just chatter. God speaks when there's something to say. And who does God speak to? Well, there are four things about the way God speaks we need to remember. First of all, God is not a mime artist. God speaks to us clearly. There are some people who say, well, you know all this stuff about God speaking in the Old Testament, it's just a poetic, fanciful way of talking. What God actually does is he does big things in front of people. The Exodus, the slavery in Egypt, the law at Mount Sinai, all that sort of thing. And God does these great acts, and then human beings reflect on them, think, oh, I wonder what God is saying. Ah, I think what God is saying is this. That's mime. That's not communication. Do you remember when mime artists were all over the Christian world a few years ago? It used to annoy me, because I don't get mime at all. I really don't. I see people doing this sort of stuff, and I can't make sense of it. And people around me are going, look what he's doing now. Oh, he's climbing out of the box. Is he? Is he really? I thought he was in a submarine. No, he's not. He's climbing through a window. Oh, really? Okay. I just can't get the point. I don't see the story. Mime is lost to me because I need words. I really do. And fortunately, God doesn't just do the big actions of history in front of us. He says what he's doing. He tells us. That's what the Bible's all about. God speaks in words that we can understand and tells us what's going on. So he speaks to Moses clearly here. And also you'll notice that the first word he uses is Moses. Moses. He calls us by name. God just doesn't spray out his instructions to the human race. He speaks to us individually and particularly. And one of the things that God wants to do with you, I'm convinced, is to speak to you plainly and say, look, I've got a plan for your life. I've got things for you to do. It's not just the special people, the Abrahams and the Moseses. I have a plan for you too. And the third thing that God does is he reveals what he's like. He shows his nature. Moses, my heart is all chewed up because of what's been happening to the Israelites. They've been in Egypt for 400 years. It's been slavery. And you might think I'm sitting there in heaven thinking, oh, everything's fine up here. It's a pity about them down there. I'm not. My heart is full of pain because of what's been happening to my people. Understand my heart. Understand how I feel. See the world with my eyes. And that'll motivate you too, because you'll begin to understand you have a God who's deeply involved in the affairs of this world. And now I want to do something about it, and I want you to be part of that as well. And that's the fourth thing, of course. He reveals his vision. He shows Moses what's going to happen. Not all of it, but enough to get him started. Has God ever met with you like that? Has God ever spoken to you and said, you, whoever you are, I've got a job for you. I've got a plan for you. Your life matters to me because you are part of my vision. This is how I feel about the people you live among. This is how I feel about the place where you work. This is how I feel about you. And this is what I want you to do. Never? Well, maybe that's because God only speaks to certain people in certain ways. You see, I think one thing this passage tells you is that God talks to people who want to do something. Moses may have failed earlier in his life. He just ended up assassinating an Egyptian and running for his life. But he wanted to do something. And if you just want to get through life sitting around and watching Coronation Street until finally you pop your clogs, that's not a great agenda. That's not what God created you for. He intended you to do something. And God will not speak to you and say, I have a plan for your life, until you're prepared to ask him what it is. Moses saw the burning bush. Many people might have seen the bush, thought, that's strange, and passed by. Moses said, I will now turn aside and see what's going on here. He had an inquiring mind. He wanted to see what was happening. God talks to people who are prepared to do something. And God talks to people who are listening. God could not only talk to Moses because he knew that despite all of his objections, all of his fears, Moses had a listening heart. He was prepared to listen to God. That was going to be what it was all about. Third thing about people who hear from God, God talks to people who will respond. God is not going to outline his plan for you and tell you what he wants you to do and show you his heart and his vision if you're going to turn into, that's very interesting, but I think I watch television instead. God only talks to people who are prepared to do something about it. If he knows you're not going to respond, he might as well save his breath, mightn't he? So the challenge to us, I guess, from the story of Moses is, how much do I want God to be real to me? God to speak to me? God to empower me so I can do something distinctive and real with my life, whatever it is? And of course, there's more to it than that. God is a God who engages us. He uses us in his service. And when we're prepared to listen, when we're prepared to catch a vision for what he wants us to do, he's prepared to make us powerful. It's very difficult preaching on this passage in some ways when you know that one of the most effective sermons in the world has already been preached about it. And not once either, because the guy who preached it again and again and again. And it affected all kinds of lives all over the world. And two of the people who were affected by this sermon are two of the most effective communicators in the world. Luis Palau, for instance, Argentinian evangelist, who's preached in Europe, who's preached in Asia, who's preached in Latin America, who's done the most amazing things in Latin America. Or Wesley Paul, the Indian evangelist, who's worked in Africa massively, changing the future of countries, worked in India, worked in the West as well. There's Palau preaching to a crowd of thousands and thousands. Here's Palau in Argentina just a few years ago in 2008, when at this Yes to Life rally, 100,000 people turned up. And the president of Argentina, Cristina de Kirchner, said that compared to political rallies that happened in the same place, this was absolutely stupendous and mind-boggling. All kinds of people became Christians. Churches were planted just as a result of that two-day campaign. Here's Wesley Paul speaking to a crowd of thousands and thousands and thousands in Africa. Men of incredible power for God. Where did they get their power from? Well, both of them, interestingly, say it comes back to the sermon I mentioned. A sermon that a guy once preached on this very passage. His name was Ian Thomas, Major Ian Thomas. Started Capernay Bible School, but before then he'd done quite a bit. He was an all-action character from the time he became a Christian when he was 17. And for the next 2 years, he founded a youth club in the East End of London. He went preaching all over the place. He did all kinds of stuff. He was just determined to be the best possible servant that God could possibly have. And in the end, he exhausted himself. And by 19, he knew he looked powerful on the outside, and inside he was a real mess. And one night, he was honest with God. He just prayed and cried out, "Look, God, I know what a hypocrite I am. Outside, people say, 'Whoa, look at him go. What a fantastic Christian.' Inside, I know I'm a sham and I'm powerless. There is nothing there at all. All that's driving me forward is my own energy and my own pride, and I'm running out of that. I'm going to run out of steam and have a nervous breakdown unless you do something." And God met with him in the most amazing way. One night in November, he says, that year, just at midnight, I got down on my knees before God and I just wept in sheer despair. I said, "With all my heart, I have wanted to serve thee. I've tried to my uttermost, and I'm a hopeless failure." That night, things happened. The Lord seemed to make plain to me that night, through my tears of bitterness. "You see, for 7 years, with utmost sincerity, you have been trying to live for me on my behalf, the life that I have been waiting for 7 years to live through you." And he said about this passage, God was trying to tell Moses, "I don't need a pretty bush, or an educated bush, or an eloquent bush. Any old bush will do, as long as I am in the bush. If I am going to use you, I am going to use you. It will not be you doing something for me, but me doing something through you." And as Ian Thomas thought about this passage about the burning bush, this strange story, he thought, why that bush? What was special about the bush? And imagine Moses having a little conversation with God. "God, why is it that that bush is on fire and not burning out? And not that one, or that one, or that one?" And God said to Moses, "I could use that one. Could use that one. Could use that one as well. I could do the same miracle through any of these bushes. Any old bush will do. You think I'm going to use you because you're educated, because you're well-connected, because you have money, because you have come from a good family, because you have lots and lots of energy and ambition? I'm not going to use you for any of those things. I cannot use bushes that want to be something for themselves. They'll just burn out. And all you have is a bunch of burned out twigs. But when somebody wants to hand his life over to me and let me be the life and the power that moves through it, then things can start to happen." And Dean Thomas started to realize that's the way it's got to be. And he said the next morning he got up to serve God in a completely different way, with a new power and a new joy. And yet, he said, nothing had been added to me that I didn't have the day before. It was all there already. All of the life of Christ was already living in him. He just had to tap into it and use it and live in the strength of God and not in his own. Well, Luis Palau was in a similar situation at Multnomah Bible College as a young student, feeling powerless on the inside when Ian Thomas came and preached that sermon, not for the first time, in College Chapel. And as Palau listened to him, he says this, "I realized I was that kind of bush, a worthless, useless bunch of dried up old sticks. I could do nothing for God. All my reading and studying and asking questions and trying to model myself after others was worthless. Everything in my ministry was worthless unless God was in the bush. Thomas told of many Christian workers who failed at first because they thought they had something to offer God. He himself had once imagined that because he was an aggressive, winsome, evangelistic sort, God could use him. But God didn't use him until he came to the end of himself. I thought, that's exactly my situation. I ran back to my room in tears and fell to my knees next to my bunk. I prayed, Lord, now I get it. I understand. I see the light at the end of the tunnel. The whole thing is not I, but Christ in me. It's not what I'm going to do for you, but rather what you're going to do through me. I realized the reason I hated myself inside was because I wrongly loved myself outside. I thought I was really something, but God was not active in the bush. I hadn't given him a chance. Well, God still had a lot of burning to do, but he was finally in control of this bush. And it's funny, the way things happen in a chain in Christian ministry. That article, that account that Louis Palau wrote about what happened to him, affected another younger evangelist, Wesley Paul. And when he read it, he said, God got through to me. I heard God saying, Wesley, don't try to be someone else you are not. I can use any old bush. I got it. I don't have to be Bonke, Billy Graham, or anyone else. I just be Wesley. What a peace. Nothing to prove. No one to keep up with. What a relief. Finally, God got through to me. The following day, he says, I asked the pastor to take me to the beach there in India. There on the sandy seashores, no, in Africa, in seashores of Africa, I asked God to bury Wesley, the ego, the pride, and all that goes with human ambition. I chanted the mantra of the Apostle Paul, I am crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live. I've not stopped praying that prayer. What happened in Africa serves as a constant reminder to crucify and bury the flesh. I cannot do what I do in the flesh, neither can you. As long as the life is in the bush, as he is in the bush, rather, you and I will be fine. Not I, but Christ living in me, says the Apostle Paul. Our inner source is Christ. He is enough. He gives us our sense of worth and dignity. I'm his servant and ambassador for Christ. Therefore, you and I don't have to prove ourselves to anyone. He will use us. He knows where we are and what we are. He's just looking for a bush. You prepared to be like that, I wonder? Now go, says God. I'll help you speak. I'll teach you what to say. This is the verse, incidentally, that we've picked as the memory verse we want to take away from this service this morning. And if you can't remember it all, remember two words. Now go. Because that's what God's saying to all of us. How does that apply to those of us who are getting older, I wonder? Because in Britain today, we have got, for the first time ever, 11 million people who are over 65 in the UK. Sorry, the colours have gone very faded as well. It's not your eyes, it's not just that you're over 65, all right. But there are now more pensioners. It's painful reading on this thing too. There are now more pensioners than there are under 16s. We're an ageing population. The number of centenarians, people of 100, living in the UK was 13,350 in 2012. That's 73% up on the 2002 figures. We're getting older, and those aged 60 in the church represent 41% of churchgoers in 2010, and if things don't change, if everything stays the same, that's going to rise to 77% by 2050. I pray it's not. One thing I think we should all be praying for, especially in the light of what we were doing here last week, is a tremendous revival amongst young people. We need to see the next generation of young people find Christ in a big way. And I believe it's going to happen one of these days, very soon indeed. The great days of Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and the atheism are over. There's a new curiosity around, and we need to pray desperately that God will turn young people's hearts back to himself. But the way it is, we've got lots of older people around. And there's a verse in Psalm 92 that makes a promise about older people, and it says this: they will still bear fruit in old age. They will stay fresh and green. Old age isn't a time for tottering down to the post office to get your pension. It's a time for passing on everything you've got to younger people. Jim Packer, who's now 88 and calls himself an older old, still around, says this: the biblical expectation, indeed promise, of rightness, growing and service of others continuing as we age with God, is the substance of our last lap image of our closing years, in which we finish our course. Runners in a distance race, like jockeys in a horse race, always try to keep something in reserve for the final sprint. And my contention is going to be that, so far as our bodily health allows, we should aim to be found running the last lap of race of our Christian life, as we would say, flat out. The final sprint, so I urge, should be a sprint indeed. And Packer's written all of this stuff in a book about finishing your course with joy, which is so important. Not just to finish, but to finish with joy. To walk hand in hand with God through all of the difficulties of old age into the future. And one phrase from the book stays with me: aging is not for wimps. It really is not. Old age throws its own challenges at us, and we need to be ready for those. Look at Billy Graham, young and old, still going for God. He says this: old age has its challenges, it is not for wimps, but God wants us to embrace it as part of his plan for our lives. God doesn't want us to waste our latter years or spend them in superficial, meaningless pursuits. Instead, he wants us to use them in whatever ways we can to influence those who will come after us. He wants us to finish well. And one of the ways we do this is by passing on our values and our faith to those who will follow us. John Allen's having a go at the old people this morning. No, I'm not, you know. Because by the time you reach this stage, you're like a liner that's set on a certain course, and turning that ship around can be very difficult. I'm talking to those of us who haven't quite got there yet. Because you now sow the seeds of the way you're going to finish the race. That's a glorious mixed metaphor, but you know exactly what I'm talking about. One of these days, you will be beyond changing your patterns. You will either finish well, or you will finish badly. You'll either finish joyfully, or you'll finish bitterly. You'll finish effectively and powerfully, or you'll finish as a footnote to history. That was the challenge that Moses at age 80 was facing here. It's a challenge that you and I face every day of our lives as we sow the patterns for the future. And God says to us, I'm all the power you need. Any old bush will do. Now go.